been a long, long week, Sean. I've been preparing. I'm getting, we launch or something next week.
Or something.
Or something. Well, I mean, we'll see. We hopefully launch like within the next couple of days here, realistically. I'm basically waiting on a bit of final information from one of our print partners, and then I'm, you know, tidying up some stuff on my end, finishing up like shipping and all that kind of stuff. But we're getting really close. I feel like this project has been, I always talk about the first 90% of a project and the second 90% of a project. I feel like I'm pretty deep into the third 90% of this project.
And then comes the fourth 90% of the project.
Right. Well, yeah, then maintaining it, which is just going to be the same amount of work over and over again.
Well, then it's like the owners and the bosses and the managers come in and they're like, okay, remember all this stuff that we said we would do post-launch? Now we're doing all of that, which is the fourth or the fifth and the sixth 90%, I think.
It is indeed. You always feel like, oh, I'm going to get this thing launched. It's all going to be good. It'll be launched. It'll be done. It's going to be off my plate. But really, every time you launch something, what you're actually doing is not getting anything off your plate, but just really switching plates.
Right. Yeah. You're turning your first plate of the buffet into the person who comes around and collects the plates, and then you're going back up to pick up another one. In fact, you don't even have to go up and pick another one. The plates come to you in this case.
No, they'll be brought to you. Trust me. The plates. There will be no shortage of plates brought to your table,
yes,
sir.
The plates are brought to you. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think honestly, like once you get over the first bump, which is the initial launch, it becomes a little bit easier. It's different. Like, I think DK's case is a little bit different maybe because we don't have like a runway where things are done if we hit the end of this runway.
Right.
But I think in your case too, once the initial, like you climbed the first major hill and now you're on the other side of it, it's a little bit easier because yeah, there's things that you have to do, but there's not like a drop dead date where this is where things are, like if it's not done, it's not getting included in the release.
Yeah. And I mean, we're really small team of two, so it's never been something where it's like there's a ton of forces working to like, oh, this feature needs to make it into the first version or whatever. I mean it's just the two of us discussing or like the three of us with advisors and stuff. Hey, Alejandro. But to me, the last bit of this project, like actually getting it to the point where it's going to go out the door, has been super difficult because it's at the point where there's a lot of features in the app. Actually, there's like a lot of stuff in it. This is probably by an order of magnitude the largest thing I've ever made pretty easily. Mm-hmm. And certainly the most complex. And what's been really tough for me, and what I'm very excited, the main reason I'm excited about launch is to get users in there so I can start figuring out what we're right about, what we're wrong about, which of those, you know, that we, of course, we have a big list of features that needs to get implemented after launch, and just like every app, but which of those actually make sense, which of those we were thinking about in the right way, which of those we were thinking about in the totally incorrect way that people actually don't care about at all, that we thought were super valuable.
Right.
And right now it's just to the point where there's so much in the app that I have really been struggling with, are we making the right decisions here? We just need to get this thing out the door. But then at the same time, you go to release it and it's like, well, but we really shouldn't launch without this.
Yeah.
And so it's always such a tough balance. And once there's actual people in there, I feel like that's going to eliminate a lot of the issues that I'm having just around like knowing, just having real data to work with.
Yeah. It's kind of like you get to that point where you have the core of things. Obviously, the core is the most important. The core is what you need for the platform to exist. And then you have lots of other things that you kind of become attached to. Like some of them have an idea like we should do this or we should add this feature that could be important. And then you kind of become attached to it. You start thinking of your project in the context of that thing existing. And I think that it's kind of important. Like, I mean, a lot of people will say like, oh, you just have to get it out the door. It's the most important thing is just to get out the door. I mean, yes and no. But I think that once you do get it out the door, it kind of helps you deal with those things that you become attached to, right? For me, it kind of helps me look at things for what they really are. I'm like, okay, yeah, I really like this idea and it might be really great, but is it necessary for the thing to function? If not,
right,
then you can proceed without it. And in fact, if you proceed without it, then what you're talking about, you can get some data, you can get some numbers from what your users are doing, and then you can actually make a decision based off of like, okay, well, these numbers maybe suggest that this thing here isn't that important really, and it might actually save you some time from building something that you might not need right away.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I feel like a lot of times, especially when you've been working on, I've been working on this project for quite a while at this point, and I've been working on it, you know, basically every single day and for many hours per day. And so in particular, a problem that I've noticed is that I think I'm too close to it to really be able to answer questions about it honestly to myself at this point. By which I mean, when I'll be working on a feature and it'll be like, okay, well, what way should this be implemented? How are people going to want to deal with this? And it's really easy to think like, oh, well, this is already solved because of X, Y, and Z. If you go to this other place in the app in your settings, you can switch this thing on or something like that. That's a bit of a contrived example. But like, sure. I know every single detail of this thing. And thinking about it from that perspective often isn't the most useful perspective to be thinking about things from. I mean, it can be very good. Like if you're implementing something that is truly complex, something that is like really a detailed thing that is for power users, then sometimes it will have to be like buried in settings or whatever. But I think there's a bit of a tendency to overcomplicate things when you are so close to a project and you don't have that user data. So I'm just user data, man. I'm so excited.
Yeah, it's going to be really cool.
As soon as somebody I don't know signs up and like starts posting stuff, oh man, that's going to be a happy day for me.
When someone that you don't know spends money on the thing that you made, that blows my mind. Like I see something, a purchase come in for more than a grand. I'm like, what the crap? You know, it's still crazy to me. But to kind of go back what you're talking about, how you're really close to it and you're spending many hours every day. The analogy that I kept thinking of is like writing music. Like when you're working on a record, you feel this pressure, like we have to release this thing. We typically like, okay, we have to finish tracking by this date. So that way it can get mixed by this date. So that way we can retrack anything that might need to be fixed by this date. So that way it can get mastered by this date. So that way it can be promoted by this date. You know what I mean? It's like, you kind of stressed out thinking about all that stuff, and then you throw like the creativity kind of stuff into it, and working like building something is pretty similar. In a similar vein, you're using your creative muscles, thinking about how to solve problems, thinking about how to structure things. It's all kind of the same creative muscles. And when you're working on a record for so long and you're so close to it, it's super hard to actually finish the songs because you get hung up on things. You get hung up on small details. You're like, oh, did I bend the string?
Yeah.
You know, is it a note like just too flat to sound good in this part of the song, when really it's like, okay, well, no one, like everyone else is going to hear it and think it's great. And what you really need to do is finish the bridge instead.
It's really easy to get caught in those details that are details that only someone who has studied this thing for hours and hours and hours and weeks and months on end is ever going to care about. I think part of what I maybe didn't really explain when I was trying to say this before is I think that because I'm so close to things and because I understand the whole app so well and so deeply, I think that often leads me to make decisions that might be very friendly to a power user, but not necessarily so friendly to someone who's new. And it's really hard to keep in that perspective of new users, even though that's a hugely critical perspective to think about when you're designing, when you're developing things.
Right.
But it's really hard to do that. I mean, it's empathy for users that have never seen something is hard to, it's kind of the same thing that makes teaching tough, right? Because once you understand something, it's really difficult to explain it to somebody else in many cases, especially with technical stuff. And so I think that's the biggest thing for me, is just that I worry that I'm not fully keeping in mind new users enough, and having that concern removed by having actual data from new users that I can look at and then use that to put me in that mindset. Oh man, I'm just stoked. I'm stoked. That's going to be nice.
I think it'll allow you to be reactionary as opposed to trying to, make assumptions and do.
Yeah.
Like you're saying, like user data helps with that a lot. I think for us too, it's kind of the same thing. Like we have all these features that we think would be great, but, you know, if the core of the product, if people aren't buying furniture, no one, you know, like then, you know, we're kind of like, either, like no matter how many collections you can create and share and blog about, if people aren't actually buying furniture, then there's something else wrong, you know, and I shouldn't focus on adding features for the collections. I should focus on, okay, why didn't someone actually click checkout or finish checkout or whatever? How does your analytics pipeline set up?
I mean, I've got a pretty standard like Google Analytics integration set up with Vue and ViewRouter and Nuxt and whatever. So that's, you know, doing its Google Analytics-y stuff. And then I do have mixed panel tied in for some stuff, probably not as much as I will eventually want to, but there's a good chunk of data that's being sent through. So
right.
That's what we're going with right now.
You're getting as much as you need up front for now.
I mean, we'll see. It's just, that's kind of another area where I don't fully know. And I haven't had time to add events to every single action in the app, you know, but the main ones are there, and especially ones around onboarding and like creation.
Sure.
Which are obviously going to be really important for us for retention as a, not a social network, but a social network like data structure.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes sense. I'm doing pretty much the same thing, mixed panel for like user things, like the main user things that we want to make sure people are doing. It's like, that's what we're focusing on now, especially with like this big rewrite. I'm actually changing some features and making some improvements on some features, I think. And what's cool is that we kind of have like these weekly catch-ups, and Lindsay, my boss, and I will talk about things, and she'll be like, I think this, you know, based off of this data, because she looks at Google Analytics way more than I do. She's like, you know, she's making, yeah, it's nice. I log in every now and then, but she's the number, she's the business person for sure. So we'll talk about stuff, and she'll say like, I think based off these numbers that this could be good for us. And then I'll agree. And then what's really cool is that since I'm kind of peeling back the lid on things, I'm able to make adjustments, and it's working out pretty well so far. I'm really happy with how the app rewrite is coming along, you know. It's probably still about a month away from being finished, but organization wise, speed wise, just how everything works together feels really good. So I'm pretty happy about that.
Do you know how you're gonna be doing that switchover yet? Is it just gonna be like shut off the Rails app, put it in maintenance mode or whatever, and then spin up the Elixir app and re-forward everything over there DNS-wise? Or do you have some sort of other migration strategy, like a piecemeal thing?
That's pretty much how it's going to have to work, because half of the Rails app is server rendered anyway, so I can't really proxy endpoints over.
Yeah, that would be rough.
And it would just be more complicated than it's worth. And so what I'm doing in development actually is... I have a copy of the production data that I download occasionally, and I scrub like user identifiable stuff because I want to be safe, passwords and things like that. So I have some, like I run a script that just scrubs that. And from there, so I just import it to my dev database. And so that way, as I'm building out the application, I'm not like making assumptions on how the data looks. I'm actually using production data.
Right. It's not you don't want to end up with the thing that so many design files have. I almost said Photoshop files, and then I realized how old I am. Sketch files or Figma or whatever the kids are using these days. But you get some design file and you look at it, and it's like a grid, but it's all the same exact photo that all is already the same aspect ratio, and all the text conveniently fits into one line. And it's like that's such a big risk. Even when you mock your own dev data, I feel like I kind of tend to do that, even though I'm trying to be conscious of not doing it, because it's easy.
Yeah. And so this is working pretty well, because I get to test both sides of it, right? So I'm developing with a lot of, you know, pertinent data that actually will be, things will be happening with that data on the production server, right? So it's really close to being what it will be. And it's really close to what the data currently is, which I think is really important. And I get to test the other side. So obviously, you know, with Ecto akin to Active Record, you have migration files. And so as I work on a new feature, I would write a migration like I would actually run it against the dev database, except I don't actually run it against the dev database. I think I have a couple of times, but then what I do is just drop it and re-import the production data. And then how I'm testing my migrations is obviously my test suite. So if my test suite is creating databases and dropping, you know, it's creating records and dropping records. So if migrations are jacked up, my tests are going to be jacked up. So I feel pretty good about that too. So it's not like I'm, you know, making all these migration files and not actually using them, because my test data is using them and everything is checking out. And in fact, I've caught a couple of things where I didn't do something quite right in a migration file and my tests bombed because of that. So I was able to be like, oh yeah, I need to change this instead.
How do you run those migrations in the first place if they don't work? Like I'm saying, you said you caught errors in migrations because of that. I'm just curious, like what the ordering of that.
Oh, looks like. No, it's more like syntactical errors in the migration file itself.
I see. Like, sure.
Yeah. So Ecto has it's pretty much like a Rails migration. So you can do up and down and so one major difference is that in Ecto, how it stores timestamps, instead of created and updated at, it's inserted at and updated at. And so I just have to make sure that when I'm defining the tables that I say use insert or use created at instead, so it matches the Rails tables.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a stupid small example, but that's one example of where if I forget to do that, then Ecto will be like, hey, there's not a field for created at.
Right.
Yeah. So it's just small things like that. I mean, there's other things like, JSON columns and things like that, making sure that those pull over correctly. But so far, I haven't had any issues. It's been pretty nice. And I feel pretty good about it because, like I said, I'm seeing in my dev environment, I'm seeing what I could technically be seeing on the actual production server because it's the same data minus the sensitive data, which really there's not much. The email address might be the biggest thing because obviously we're using Stripe, so we don't actually store like credit card numbers or details or anything like that.
Isn't that amazing? Like what a huge time saver and just saver it is never have to think about, are there credit cards here that need to be obfuscated or removed or whatever? It's just, never think about it.
I was paranoid at first because I was like, can I do this? Is this illegal for me to do? Download a copy of my production database and use it? And then I read a bunch of Stack Overflow posts and some people were like, don't ever do that. Don't ever do it. And some people were like, it's fine, just scrub the data. And so I started looking at it and I was like, well, we're not storing anything. Like if someone stole my laptop, they couldn't make a transaction because they don't have the production keys. Like I don't have the production keys stored in my dev environment. Those are all either in 1Password, which they're not getting into, or they're on Heroku, which I have 2-factor auth, so they're still not getting into it. So a side note, I've been using 1Password's one-time password feature for 2-factor auth logins, and it's great.
Yes, there was actually a big update for that as well, or not a big update, but big for me, in 1Password 6.8, I think, which just came out. And now whenever you fill a login for a site where you have a 2-factor in there, it will automatically copy the current 2-factor code to your clipboard. Fantastic, fantastic addition. I love it. It makes 2-factor so much easier to deal with.
I cried tears of joy. The Authy Chrome app is a pile of trash, and I installed it so fast when I learned about the 1Password, 1-factor or 2-factor auth anyway.
Yeah, but they do a great job.
But yeah, I was paranoid about that stuff, and now I'm not. It works super, super well, and I think it's smart because of the complexity of like the shipping stuff and the complexity of, an order having multiple stores in having multiple products from multiple different stores in an order. It's just, I'm mocking data for it for my tests, obviously, but it's just so much easier if I'm able to also download the production data and run it in development and make sure that things are working out.
Yeah, well, I mean, even if you do mock all that data in tests, you still, when you're clicking around in development mode, like, you want it to be realistic. So it would be weird if your test said perfectly formed data, but then you're clicking around and it's actually all empty. That's not really any way to build an app.
Yeah, exactly. So it just makes it, obviously, like, too, another big thing is, I could generate 1,000, 10,000 products and, like, look at what this looks like. With lots of rows, like you'll find out real quick if someone's somehow like nesting structures in a JSON response. You'll find out super fast because the page will be very slow. So it just kind of helps stuff like that, and it's been really nice, especially in learning Phoenix, having data there that I know works and I know how it's structured. It kind of takes away part of the equation of figuring something out. Because I'm familiar with the data. And so then it just becomes focusing on, like, okay, so I know how it should look and it doesn't look like that. And now I need to figure out why.
Oh man. When are you going to be up in San Francisco? You're in California right now. Yeah.
I'll roll up there at some point. I'm not sure yet. I'll have to figure it out.
All right. I want to get you in this virtual reality, man.
I need to get into the virtual reality. I was talking with Jamie and her mom about escape rooms, and I was like, I'll build you all the escape rooms you want. Just let me get a VR headset.
Yeah. Yeah. Could do that. Those do exist. I need to try one of those, actually.
So I built that PC. I think we talked about that, right? I think we talked about it.
I mean, we've talked about it. I don't know if we talked about it on the show.
So I want to talk about this M.2 madness that I just learned about.
I haven't heard
of
this.
It's like a flash. It's not really, it's small like a flash drive. It connects directly to the motherboard. And apparently it's crazy fast. Like my jiu-jitsu instructor actually is the one who told me about it.
This is a storage, like a SSD kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just okay. It's just like a little SSD chip. It's super small. It's like half the size of a stick of RAM. And it snaps into your hard drive. And my jiu-jitsu instructor was saying he gets over a gigabyte per second write speeds.
It snaps onto your hard drive?
Yeah.
It's like in addition to a hard drive?
Or no, it snaps into your motherboard. Sorry.
Oh, I see. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. That's really cool. What kind of storage capacity are we talking about?
I mean, like 250 gigabytes, 500 gigabytes.
Okay. So like a full drive.
Yeah. It's an actual drive.
I'd imagine that's probably very similar to what gets used in like MacBooks and other laptops.
I would imagine too. Yeah. That's what I was thinking about because they're so small and look like obviously building a PC. I'm like, wow, this thing takes up a lot of room. And then I look at my PS4 and I'm like, how do they cram all that stuff in there? And then
right.
I look at my MacBook Pro and I was like, how did they cram that stuff in there?
It's really incredible, man. I actually just I had a Windows desktop that I used for virtual reality dev and whatnot and other various gaming pursuits. But I just recently switched to an MSI gaming laptop, which is actually more powerful than the desktop I have. This thing is a beast.
It's wild.
It's ridiculous how much technology they cram into these things now.
Have you tested, like, do you have it all set up and ready for dev yet?
Yeah, I've been doing some dev. I've actually been getting a little bit back to doing some Microcosm work. I haven't told you about this yet. I forgot that I hadn't told you this. So I was pretty like not super into working on Microcosm for a while, probably almost a month, like three to 4 weeks. Partly because, you know, I've been super busy with Nest Notes and just other life stuff going on. We've had a lot of life stuff lately.
Sure.
But the biggest reason was because I suddenly stopped getting sales. And I was like, okay, well, I guess my launch visibility ended and I fell off, you know, like the second page of results, new listings or whatever, right, on Steam.
Right.
And it was kind of bumming me out because I was like getting zero sales, completely dead for weeks and weeks. And I didn't even realize that this is actually get me down. But I was like, well, I mean, if nobody cares at all, why should I care either? Which is not a healthy attitude, but I felt myself slipping into that, right?
Sure.
Turns out somehow Steam messed up something somewhere at some point and actually had unlisted my game for sale.
Weird.
So it was still showing up like in all the store pages and everything, but when you clicked on it there was just no buy button. And thanks to Daniel McMahon, friend of the show, for raising this to me when he bought his Vive. He was like, I tried to buy your game but there's no button. And I don't know how much longer I wouldn't have found out if he hadn't done that. So thanks again, Daniel. But yeah, so I messaged Steam and it's all resolved now and I'm getting sales again, and
that's good.
Yeah. It's amazing how much imposter syndrome will let you just believe that the stuff you do is worthless, though.
Yeah. It's kind of like one of those things where this person says this and you're like, okay, well, they said that. I'm not going to hang out with them, or I'm not going to, you know what I mean? It's kind of easy to be like, well, it's not selling anything. I don't feel like doing anything on it because there's no reward there.
Right. Well, and I mean, that's ridiculous because the entire reason I made the game is because it's the game I've wanted to play for forever. So it doesn't really matter. Like, even if there were zero sales, it doesn't really matter in terms of the original goal. But it's super demoralizing through that. So it was just funny that ended up being an issue on Steam's side. But they gave me like an extra visibility round and stuff. So that's pretty cool with them.
Yeah, no, I hadn't. I know you hadn't talked about Microcosm in a while, but I didn't think to ask anything about like how I, like, again, we haven't really talked to each other.
Yeah. I mean, we've both been swamped.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what's been up. My sleep schedule has been jacked up. I haven't been sleeping. So I felt like a zombie for a straight week.
Oof. It's no fun. But yeah, anyway, long way to answer that question, I guess. But yes, I do have the laptop set up for dev and it's wonderful. I'm very excited. The reason I switched to a laptop is of course, as you know, but listeners probably don't, is because my wife and I are going to be moving into an RV in a couple months here.
Mm,
which we can talk. We can talk about more as that approaches, and I start doing episodes from the RV.
You can truck on over to Vermont.
I
know a couple of fields you could park in,
and probably will at some point, but not right away because we're going to be leaving in the winter, and
yeah,
the pipes would certainly burst.
Yeah, you would get stuck over there. It's wild there. I just don't go outside. Like, I was sitting outside this morning. I think that's the most sun I've gotten in a while, and I'm burnt right now. And it was foggy, and I'm confused about that, but I'm getting back into my California lifestyle of realizing that the sun is hot no matter if there's clouds.
Yep.
But that's cool. I mean, I don't think have we mentioned that on the show, that you're planning on doing that?
The RV thing? No, we have not. I mean, not until now.
I'm sure people have many questions about that.
Well, if you do have questions about that, hit us up on Twitter and we can actually start making a list of things that people are curious about, or people who think I'm an idiot or whatever. But just sure a list that, of every, all the responses. We'll have a list.
You'll get all the responses either way.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't be surprised if you somehow end up with the caravan called the Silicon Trail.
Oh my God, the Silicon Trail. I'm calling it there.
The Silicon Trail, however you want to pronounce it.